High blood pressure. High blood pressure. High blood pressure. You're listening to WGXC,
Acra,
Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM. We're here for you.
Hello, this is Matthew Whitney Harrington from Camp Hill Hudson, the Camp Hill Hudson Players Theater Troupe will present encore production of their original play, Happiness in the Spotlight. Have you ever asked yourself what makes you happy? You will include to see our cast finds within the backdrop of a award ceremony where everyone is dressed in a nice through energy. Funny, pointing scenes, this play comes Mount Media piece along with live. The performance is free and will be filmed in front of a live audience. So, play a role, bringing the lives. Action Theater is playing to movie screen. We hope to see you there on Friday, November 10th, 2023 at 6 p.m.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more. Plus, advance notice of close-up conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Socrates, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org/support. That's upstatefilms.org.
WGXE is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Carmen Borgia of Catskill, New York. WGXE's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXE as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm trying to get the people saying
This song I'm going to do it's called The Robin Dance. It's a song in honor of the robins, and it mimics the way they hunt. The dancers stand sideways, and they're doing a sidestep, and then at a certain part in the song, they jump to the other side and go face the other direction. It mimics how they hunt the robin.
Ya, 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 no, hawa, no, hawa. Ya, ya, ya.
Ya, 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 no, hawa, no, hawa.
Welcome to Pumicito Kwak Kalistok, an indigenous sound walk at Wave Farm. Pumicitok means let's walk, and Kalistok means let's listen. And it comes from the Muncie Delaware language that is still spoken in our communities today. Quinganawaloma, Kolalinda Minnan Alpayak, and Ashishwanakwion, Kristen Jacobs, Ashinzion. Shuk enda chilinixion ni naminitoi ashinzion loanachin ochque. Non giai elnapawi lachgawit. Wich jau dami minzi. When I speak English, my name is Kristen Jacobs, and when I speak Delaware, my spirit name is Northwind Woman. I'm from the Wolf Clan, and I live in elnapawi lachgawit, which is Delaware Nation in Ontario, Canada. You are standing in the homeland of the Lenape people. For countless generations, we cultivated corn, beans, squash, and sunflowers in the rich bottomlands nearby, fished and gathered edible plants in the wetlands of the Hudson River, and hunted for deer, elk, and bears in these mountains. Our neighbors, the Mahicanau, speak a similar language and lived here as well. On the sound walk, you will learn a little bit about our homeland. We were forced out of our land over 2 centuries ago, but today our communities can be found in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. Station 9. The Lenape language is extremely descriptive, and names for birds are a good example of this. Spend some time under this dense white pine and listen for the songs of local birds. You might hear muskchililish, or black-capped chickadee, a titis, or blue jay, or even a kokos, or barred owl. All of these names describe these bird species' calls.
You are listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. And this program is Bequency. Bequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom that bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our own neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a freeform mix of sounds made by birds and humans inspired by birds. We started today's show with Robin Song by Teresa Bear Fox. It is from an upcoming release by Underwater Panther Coalition, which is a record label created to represent indigenous voices, and this label is run by my fellow WGXC programmer, Matthew O'Neill. Matthew is the host of Panther Mountain Sound here on WGXC that airs on the third Wednesdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And for today's show, I'm very excited to bring this interview that I did with Justin Wexler of Wild Hudson Valley. Justin is a local ethnoecologist and the co-creator of that indigenous sound walk at Wave Farm, here at Wave Farm, that honors the native people of the region and their ancestors. And so the bits of the narration we heard was from this audio walk that we heard at the beginning of today's show. In this interview, Justin shares birds' names and their significance in Lenape folklore, indigenous peoples' ancient knowledge of nature, such as bird migrations and natural medicines, and he also discusses the importance of cultural and linguistic diversity. So I hope you stick around and enjoy the interview. Without further ado, let's listen to this really exciting interview. Hope you enjoy.
I started Wild Hudson Valley in 2013. I had just graduated from Bard with a master's in education, and I've worked in environmental education since I was a teenager, and I realized that I was not suited to classroom teaching. I connected better with people, bringing them out into the outdoors. Yeah. I think I wanted to do something that would contribute to society. It's one of the reasons why I've always focused on teaching. But I feel like humanity is becoming more and more, and it's well known that, you know, how disconnected humanity as a whole is becoming from the earth. And so, you know, I thought that I could help connect people to the earth, help create a more eco-literate society by teaching people with tools from the past. So when I was a kid, like 7, 8 years old, I was obsessed with the outdoors, and I wondered, you know, I soon realized the people who would have the deepest, most intimate knowledge of the outdoors would be the people who lived here for generations, native people. And I grew up in the Hudson Valley, and going to the school library, I soon realized that the people who call the Hudson Valley their ancestral home no longer live here, that, you know, they've been displaced to Ontario and Wisconsin and Oklahoma. So I started the research that I'm still doing today in ninth grade in high school, going to Columbia Green, so I could get access to various 17th and 18th century documents, and it's gone from there. I'm still working on some of the same databases of, you know, for example, bird names or plant names and the different dialects of the Hudson Valley. That it's been a continuous work for 20 plus years now. For the past 10 years, I've been working with their descendant communities that are living out west now. And part of what Wild Hudson Valley does, besides, you know, providing a space where people could visit from throughout the Hudson Valley and elsewhere and connect with nature, we also regularly host Lenape or Mohican people who are visiting their ancestral land here. We provide a space for them where they can reconnect with their homeland and represent themselves, teaching about themselves. So it's not always, you know, a nerdy, non-Native person like myself doing it.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to ask you to introduce your name.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. And I can be long-winded talking. So
Don't worry about it.
My name is Justin Wexler. Okay. Yeah.
And so you're one of the co-founder of Wild Hudson Valley.
Yep. I started it right around the time I met Anna, my wife. And she joined and became a part of this really just 3 years ago. And her expertise is in agroforestry. Both her academic background and her career has been entirely in growing ginseng and in various other sustainable forest farming practices. So we've combined our two skill sets together to teach people and connect them to the world, to the woods better.
So you have workshops and presentation and things like that. And like walks, do you do bird walks here too?
Oh yeah, yep. We every weekend, so we do offer overnight stays between Memorial Day weekend and Indigenous Peoples Day weekend normally. Mm-hmm. And as part of the overnight stays, we do programming all weekend. We do guided walks and presentations on a variety of subjects. Some weekends are themed, but virtually every weekend we offer a early morning bird walk, depending on the time of the summer, usually at 6 or 6:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And we nearly always get at least half our camp guests on that, which surprised me. I thought a lot of people wouldn't be up for getting up that early. We rarely get birders here. We get, which it's not a bad thing. We are getting guests that are here to learn about the environment. They don't necessarily have previous knowledge, which is great. Those are the people we want. Although it's really fun when we get birders who already, you know, I learn from them every time. Mm-hmm. But we do an early morning bird walk. We also do presentations. We've done presentations multiple times over the years on birds, including this past spring we did one with a local wildlife rehabilitator where she was bringing up birds of prey that she's healing, and I talked about their names and their role in the folklore of Native peoples of the Hudson Valley.
Well, I learned about you in Wild Hudson Valley was really because Wave Farm, the WGXC. Mm-hmm. I mean, this very program is on.
Mm-hmm.
We have your fantastic audio walk that introduced all the Indigenous peoples, heritage in our own campus. And there was mentions of bird names.
Yeah.
And that was really fun to listen to it. And then I saw that you had a bird lore presentation. All those documentations, the historic documentations, mm-hmm. where do they come from?
All over you'd be amazed at where the lengths you have to go. So without a time machine, the only way we can really understand what the world was like here before colonization is by casting a wide net. And so we have eyewitness records created by the first colonists who came here and subsequent colonists who came, but those always have to be used very carefully because they're written by, you know, and usually in another language from 400 years ago, like 17th century Dutch, even English has changed, written by people who have their own motives and biases, who are outside observers of the other culture, of the Lenape people that I'm trying to learn about. And those are very limited. There are not very many. Lenape people have an oral culture, so they pass down knowledge, you know, through the generations orally. They did not have a true written language until they adopted the Roman alphabet in the 18th century. But for bird names, we really start seeing them, a few of them, in vocabularies from the 17th century, from the 1600s, mostly written by traders and missionaries. And in the 18th century, missionaries, by the end of that period, we started getting the first scholars interested in their languages, Thomas Jefferson being one, who's very interested in the native languages of North America. And so he sent out people to record vocabularies, many of which come from languages that haven't been spoken for 150 or 200 years. Mm-hmm. So, but also in surprising places, I find bird names sometimes in, court documents, arguing over land boundary disputes, and they bring in native witnesses, people who, you know, who had sold the land or involved in the land sale, and they'll mention that such and such boundary is named because of whatever species lives there. So you never know where you're going to find this kind of stuff. Fortunately, one of the two main Lenape languages once spoken in Hudson Valley, it's what linguists today call Munsee. It is still spoken as a first language by one woman, Diane Snake. She lives in the Moravian Town Reserve. But there were many Munsee speakers as recently as 30 or 40 years ago in the communities in Ontario, like Moravian Town, because there are three displaced communities in Ontario. And the environment there is very similar to the Hudson Valley and Catskills. The bird and tree species are largely the same. So they were able to maintain a very rich knowledge of bird lore and bird names until today, really. So their communities in Ontario, they've worked their own language departments of people to record bird names recently and since the 1960s. So, you know, many are still in use, which is really, really neat. So, I mean, I have records of some of this folklore being passed down from their ancestors here, and I'm sure almost all of it was, but, they hold on to a lot of knowledge today. And so I'm constantly learning from Lenape people, either when visiting their communities or more often when hosting them here in their homeland. And birds are a huge part of their culture.
You're listening to Bee Quincy on Wavefarms WGXC. And my today's guest is Justin Wexler, a local ethnoecologist and the founder of Wild Hudson Valley, which is a forest farm, outdoor education, and eco campground in Greene County. Thanks for listening.
So you have access to the first-hand source of this history information, which I think is really important, because I was wondering about that. The indigenous people in Japan, there's some Ainu people in the north, and I've read some of the essays that one Ainu linguist who existed in the early 20th century or something, and he was writing. There were few other well-known Japanese main islander linguists who study Ainu language, and this Ainu linguist was complaining about how the dictionaries that they made are actually wrong. I guess they meant it well, like they're trying to understand other people's culture also, but because their standpoint coming from the conquerors, the invaders, or colonizer, I guess, point of view, I guess you just, it's kind of hard to maybe neutralize that position and really stand on the same ground as those people, maybe.
That's one reason why I prefer that my work is reviewed by the Lenape people themselves. And most, so the vocabularies the databases I've created of their names for plants and their different dialects, her birds and other animals, I only share with their community members, with their language departments, and with two or three scholars. I would not make any of that public just yet until I had a consensus, you know, from their people giving permission to do that. Because really that knowledge belongs to them. And this is my way of, you know, I got to grow up in their ancestral land and I've had the privilege of having had the time to do this. And so, you know, there's my way of giving back to them because I get to live here. Mm-hmm. So, and their bird names are so cool. Like, they're really amazing, yeah. I think.
So you mentioned in the one of the audio walks, which I will play on this same episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think that audio included blue jays
mm-hmm.
and chickadee, I believe.
Blue jays calling right now.
Yeah, right now. And so maybe you can give us more examples of other bird names.
Sure. So I did that work along with Kristen Jacobs, who's Wolf Clan. She comes from Elenapewi Lakewi, or in the Moravian Town Reserve, but she also has family in Muncie, which is right upriver from there. So two communities descended from here. And I chose, in creating that part of the Sunwalk, bird names that are onomatopoeia, because many of their bird names describe their calls. And that's true
which
for many
I think
languages.
Is smart,
yes,
actually.
And English does it too with many bird names, like chickadee is an example. Mm-hmm. And they do the same thing. I think theirs tend to be a little more accurate than English. But, you know, Algonquian languages and the languages of Hudson Valley are in the Algonquian language family. They're polysynthetic languages, so they're very descriptive. Every word is made up of different elements with meaning. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, I think, because of that, for someone who speaks an Indo-European language like English to learn one in Algonquin language. They're a little more complex in that way, but they allow them to be very descriptive when it comes to species names or place names.
Mm-hmm.
And so I haven't done an analysis, but I would say close to half their bird names describe the call.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half describe some aspect about the bird. It could be its habits, what it looks like, its habitat, or sometimes something about the bird's place in their religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that practicality, especially mm-hmm. as a, you know, learner of the English language and learning bird names in English, like Lincoln Sparrow, like who the heck is Lincoln
right.
to begin with? Like yep. Abraham Lincoln or which, I don't even know which Lincoln.
Yep.
Like, and it doesn't really help me remember what the bird looks like or sounds like.
No, it's a good point.
Yeah. So yeah, I love that. So maybe, can you, let's see. What is Carolina Wren?
Ooh, that's a good question. So Carolina Wrens did not live here until recently.
Uh-huh.
In fact, when I was a kid, I started bird watching probably first or second grade. Mm-hmm. And I paid a lot. I would keep journals over when species would arrive in the springtime. And I don't think I saw Carolina Wren until 2002 or 2003 in
that's
Columbia
very
County.
Recent. Yeah.
Cool. I'm sure they were here a little earlier, mm-hmm. but I haven't looked into, you know, the data on that. But in one of the Lenape languages, the Wenami dialect, which was once spoken in the coastal plain of New Jersey in the lower Delaware Valley, and was last spoken in Oklahoma, they were familiar with Carolina Wrens. They, huh. which, you know, even 400 years ago lived down there and live in Oklahoma. So their word for Carolina Wren is hilutit or hinutit, which means little old man. yeah.
I guess it makes sense. I mean, the name says Carolina Wren.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have been more south.
Yes. Yep.
So that was a silly question.
No, it wasn't. But for other wrens, like the house wren and possibly winter wren, in the Muncie language spoken up here, their word is shalom hakwus, which means always underneath logs, because they hide, like hiding in underbrush and under logs.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's winter wren, you said?
Either winter or house wren or both. I'm not sure.
Mm.
Whatever they were seeing more often, I would guess. Probably house wrens around their houses, mm-hmm. You know, as an edge bird. But one ethnographer in the 1930s said that, recorded the information that they hide under logs because they were scared of the comet spirit. So Nanindoes, who's basically a flying panther, basically, and it's visible as comets when they come through, go through the
comets.
Sky. Yes, not shooting stars or meteors, but comets, which is an important Manitu or deity for them. Mm. And he never recorded the story of why wrens were afraid of the comets. I'm sure there's some story where a wren in ancient times really got on the bad side of this powerful being, but as far as I know, nobody knows that story today, and it wasn't recorded.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then, right. So I should really think about what are the birds that would have been here.
Mm.
So, like, what about American crow?
So their word for they, depending on the dialect, it describes a call. Mm. So it could be ahas or ahasos or ahasho. So
that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, they describe them going ahas, which I'm not going to do. But yeah, they see crows show up in their folklore a lot as messengers.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and as birds that are very good at speaking. And they also sometimes show up in Northeastern Native folklore as having brought corn to people or sometimes beans in ancient times. And so as a result, there's a tradition in many Northeastern Native communities across cultures that, you know, if crows take corn from your field, you let them take some, basically. However, if you're planting corn on a tiny scale, like I do, I've never planted more than a quarter acre in a year, and I plant extremely rare native varieties. It's very dangerous if you let a crow take corn from your field because they'll take too much and you'll get genetic bottleneck. The corn gets inbred. Mm. So I actually buy these replica dead crows and hang them. Like there's one hanging back there and they work.
Oh, yeah. That looks real.
It's made with real feather. Before I did that, in some years, I would have to plant three times and every time the crow would show up within a day and pull up every seedling.
Oh, my God.
And eat the corn at the seed at the end.
Gotta take a picture of you with that.
Yeah.
That fake dead body of the crow.
But yeah, crows, they often show up in their stories as, you know, and how could they not? They're also associated with a group of birds that they call meat birds. That includes crows, ravens, eagles, as well as nighthawks, weirdly enough.
Hmm.
Because nighthawks, we think of, you know, think of as insectivores. But for them, and I actually have a picture from John James Audubon of a nighthawk. I have a few printouts that I use when teaching people here. Nighthawks, which have declined drastically in this area, are very spiritually important, or were in the past for Hudson Valley Native people. They associate them with the thunder beings, so the deities or spirits that bring rain and that fight underworld beings with lightning. Mm. And they actually have a being called, so their word for nighthawk is pish. And pish is a very interesting word. It describes the call nighthawks make, but it also secondarily is related to the verb for farting.
Uh-huh.
So, and that is a widespread idea throughout Eastern North America. Archaeologists associate from the Mississippian cultures, civilization down south, there's a diamond shape. That's supposed to, they say it's shaped like an anus, that it represents a nighthawk. Because when the nighthawk dives or booms, birders and ornithologists say, they make this amazing loud sound. Have you heard it before in person?
No.
Some people describe it as like a tractor trailer going by. For native people in Eastern North America, for them, it sounded like a huge fart, I guess. But as silly as that sounds, they saw this bird and see this bird as kind of a go-between between the sky world, the first level of the sky world, where there are these powerful thunder beings, and the underworld and the earth below. So they see nighthawks as a very powerful bird, and they had a whole dance annually about nighthawks. And they're also sacrificed to, in the fall, meat to nighthawks, as well as crows, ravens, and hawks and eagles, in the hope of having better hunting in the fall for deer. Mm. So they literally will offer burnt meat and fat sacrifice. I don't know if anyone still does that, but until the early 20th century, people, native hunters, were doing that.
This is Bequency on Wavefarms WGXC Radio. We'll take a little break here and listen to a short piece of music, a tune titled Hummingbird, the Spiritual Father of the Flowers.
Shenga. Umba Shoma Shoma Yukana Pusha Wunka So Kinjenga.
That was Hummingbird, the Spiritual Father of the Flowers, a song by Teyuna Mamos and Zaga of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. A track from Music for the Mother, an album released by Underwater Panther Coalition, a record label created to represent indigenous voices, and it is run by my fellow WGXE programmer, Matthew O'Neill, the host of Panther Mountain Sound. Let's get back to my interview with Justin Wexler, a local ethnoecologist and the founder of Wild Hudson Valley, which is a forest farm, outdoor education, and eco campground in Greene County.
Oh, and by the way, I just remember the word for nuthatch means, it means looking closely for something. So someone who's always looking very closely for something.
Uh-huh.
So another very descriptive one over their behavior.
Yeah. Both of them, the red-breasted, white-breasted.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if they were distinguished. Sometimes, so for warblers, they're, and vireos, they're pretty much all called the same name, which means little yellow bird.
I was wondering about that, because there are a lot of different warblers who are here only part of the year.
Mm-hmm.
They're not year-round birds, and you know, when you're not the exactly resident, how much influence they would have in the folklore.
Yeah, they don't show up, and even in terms of names. Now, you know, keep in mind that because so much was lost through the trauma of colonization and being forced out of their homeland, a lot of knowledge was lost over the past 400 years. And so, you know, there likely were names for that differentiated at least a few warbler species, but those were just lost with time. I know in other northeastern Algonquian languages like Penobscot, they differentiate at least Louisiana water thrush and the American red start. The water thrush is described for its call as being flute-like, and the red start is described, I think, either as resembling a small red-winged blackbird or by a name that describes the patches on their wings as looking like fire. But yeah, generally warblers and vireos are just called little yellow bird. So
that's what I call them too.
Yeah. They're so hard to tell apart.
On the bird walk with other people, I'm like, there's a bird, yellow, and it's small. Like, what are they? They have to tell me what they are for the most part.
Especially in the fall. It's the worst time to...
They're not even yellow.
No, they're...
They're more like brown.
They're
now.
Brownish.
Everybody's brownish.
Yeah.
What about turkey? Turkey must be.
Turkey, yeah. Oh, turkeys are really important to them. So... The generic word for turkey in Munsee is palau, or palau, and that is just the root word for birds, specifically more for landfowl birds like turkeys, grouse, quail, heath hens. But yeah, that word also refers to one of their fratries and their clans. So native people in Hudson Valley traditionally were and are, at least in some of their communities today, a matrilineal society. And you so you belong to your mother's family, to your mother's tribe or nation and clan. And in some places, those clans were named after bird species. And actually, around here in Greene County and in the very western part of Columbia County, the clans seem to have mostly been turkey clan. So I can find turkey clan out this way, heron, and... possibly killdeer and heath hen, which is an extinct bird that used to live here. And the heron and turkey clan survive today in Ontario. And heron clan is still a clan, maybe turkey clan in Munsee in Ontario at least. So some of them, you know, they're still found in their communities today. But yeah, those bird clans that all were within the turkey grouping were actually very prominent in this part of the Hudson Valley, interestingly. So if you look at documents like land deeds and treaties, they often are signed with a turkey picture by the leaders. And their word for turkey, it's palau in the Mohican language, also spoken here. And I might not say this right, it's something like nahamau. And again, that just refers, I think, to large land birds. I don't know if it has any meaning.
Large land bird.
Yeah, it doesn't literally mean that. It just like... it means that family.
Mm-mm.
Interestingly, the word for turkey, palau, is also related to their word palesu, which is the word for the thunder beings, who are very important deities for them, in that they are the Manitouak deities who have the closest contact with human beings.
Mm.
And actually, they see the thunder beings as a type of bird, literally as a type of bird. They're not just supernatural beings, but they migrate with the seasons.
Oh.
And so, you know, today we're in the 21st century, of course, but that belief still holds true among all Eastern Woodlands peoples, as far as I know. And the reason I say today it's the 21st century is because if I go on social media in the springtime, I'll often see Native friends, they could be Ojibwe or Mohawk or Lenape, and they'll say, oh, you know, the thunderbirds or thunder beings have returned, you know, from their migration to the south.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's true. You hear the last thunder in the fall and you hear the first thunder in the spring, and there's a general break in the winter. So to them, they're migrating south.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in the time of bird migration south right now. And that's another fun thing, I think, in that they have and traditionally had a very strong knowledge of bird migration. Which should, you know, it might seem obvious to people today, but in Western Europe, just a few hundred years ago, many people believed, including some scholars, that birds, they didn't know that they migrated. They thought that they were going dormant and hibernating in the mud of ponds or transforming into other animals.
Mm.
And here they had a firm knowledge of bird migration, which I think is really pretty amazing.
Yeah, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why thunder is such a big thing. I'm asking this because thunder in Japanese language related to like grain lights or like rice lights or like,
wow.
And it just means that there's a season that, you know, thunder starts maybe like early summer or something.
Yeah.
And that's an important factor in the farming.
Uh-huh.
And so I can sort of guess, you know, why thunder is such a thing. It's sort of connected to the deity of agriculture.
That is so cool.
Was that something like, how does the thunder relate to
yeah their... Oh no, absolutely, it relates to their agriculture.
Hmm.
So first and foremost, and this belief is found throughout North America, the thunder beings are usually assigned the task of fighting underwater beings or underworld beings.
Hmm.
So there are huge serpent type beings that live in deep bodies of water. And I wouldn't call them evil per se, but they're associated more with disorder and chaos and darkness. So even the little worms you get hiding in the husk of an ear of corn damaging your corn, they're also an underworld being. They're hiding underneath causing damage and destruction. And so the thunder, they shoot their lightning arrows and they kill any of those beings who expose themselves.
Mm.
And so they expect the Lenape people that part of their corn crop should go to the thunder beings. And so any corn that's withered and the ear didn't fill out by the end of the season is assumed to have been eaten by the corn, I mean, by the thunder beings.
Mm-hmm.
And another word for thunder beings besides palesu, which compares them to large birds, is pitaquo. I'm not saying it right, but I think it means those who bring the clouds. So the cloud bringers. So they're mm-hmm. They're surrounded by clouds wherever they move and bring the rain with them. And they were also given the task of bringing the rain to water the corn. So they bring rain to water the corn and other crops, and in return they take some of the corn crop.
Hmm.
So they're also associated with agriculture.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I can keep asking you, like, what about this bird? What about that bird? What about this bird? For like in hours and hours. But what about vulture? You mentioned vulture.
So earlier. Vultures rarely ever show up in their folklore, but they have the word for vulture means someone who like has disgusting eating habits,
well,
basically.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, which is also very descriptive. Okay. The turkey vulture would have been the only species that they were regularly familiar with. I mean, I don't think I ever saw a black vulture in the Hudson Valley until 2010 or 11. So they're fair, and they're still not as common as turkey vultures.
Turkey vultures, maybe.
Yes.
But there are a lot of black vultures now, too.
Oh, yeah. There's more and more, it seems, every year.
Mm.
But the turkey vulture is the one they would have been seeing hundreds of years ago, I think. And, yeah, I don't... So, actually, there is something about turkey vultures. So The oil rendered from turkey vultures is believed to be good for rheumatism.
What is that?
The oil. So if you kill a turkey vulture and you cook it so that, and take the oil that drips out, mm-hmm. or that skim the oil off the pot from boiling it, that was believed to be beneficial to rub on your joints for arthritis.
Ooh.
To rub on your knees or elsewhere in your body for pain, if I'm remembering correctly. And that was something the settlers learned from them. And so there are records from the 17th and 18th century of the settlers killing turkey vultures and rendering oil from them for using for rheumatism. Mm. And apparently the method for carrying a turkey vulture was to put a cord through their nostrils. I know this sounds really brutal, so that you wouldn't have to hold it that much because, I mean, presumably they don't smell very good.
Probably not from what they're eating.
But that was an easy way to carry them.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's one thing about turkey vultures.
It's another thing that makes you wonder, like, how did they come up with doing that? Like, why didn't they even think of trying that?
Who knows? They use all different animal oils for different, like skunk oil, which doesn't smell that much. It's just the oil. It's not the scent glands.
Right.
It's still known and used, I think, by Lenape people today. It's rubbed on a chest for bronchial illnesses, so like coughs. So who knows, you know, how people come across that knowledge over many generations.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Even things that we eat, I mean, I eat, say, like shellfish, because everybody eats it. Like, my family eat it, Japanese people eat it. If I were the first human being to eat shellfish, like, I don't know what I would thought of that, just the look of it.
Right.
Also, that it's protected. Like, why would you, like, think of, like, plying it open?
Exactly,
like, this thing? Like, you have to be, like, really hungry to give it a shot.
That's like, interesting.
I just can't imagine, like, how did anything happen? Like, herbs and all those medicinal things, you know, knowledge. Like, we know because somebody told us.
Right.
We don't just know it. Like, who? It's incredible, these ancient knowledge.
I don't know. Many Native people will say that sometimes they learn directly from the plant or animal that they'll... So for Eastern Woodlands people like the Lenape, from my understanding, they live in relationship with the world around them, and everything you see can be sentient. Mm-hmm. Even a rock has sentience and is capable of communicating with you and will appear to you in human form sometimes to communicate with you. You know, it's possible. And so they learn a lot of, you know, tricks and medicines and stuff directly from plants and animals.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, that's one source that they would say, at least. I mean, mostly everything's passed down, and a lot is learned through experimentation too, I know, as well.
This is Frequency on Waveforms WGXC, and you're listening to an interview with Justin Wexler, a local ethnoecologist and the founder of Wild Hudson Valley.
I was going to ask you, why do some bird names don't exist in the Lenape people's culture? But you've already explained a lot. So they simply didn't exist sometimes.
Yeah.
Because of the climate changing.
Yep. So titmice didn't exist as far north. Carolina wrens, cardinals were not in Hudson Valley. Mockingbirds were not.
Wow.
But we had birds that no longer are found here, at least not commonly. So crossbills were probably breeding here.
Hmm.
And I think they were breeding in the Catskills into the 19th century at high elevation. What else? I mean, some birds are extinct that were abundant here, like passenger pigeons and heath hens.
Mm-hmm.
Others no longer breed here, like sandhill cranes used to at least pass through regularly on migration.
Hmm.
And so they're a bird that are prominent sometimes in their folklore, but don't live in the Hudson Valley anymore, other than, you know, rarely passing through.
Mm.
So the world has changed a lot in the past 400 years.
Makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for this fantastic interview.
Thank you so much for making the trip over here and hosting. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. And I recommend, you know, if anybody really, really wants to learn about the words for birds used by Lenape people, if you shoot me an email through Wild, you could contact me through wildhudsonvalley.com. I would be happy to share a resource. It's an article written by an ethnologist in the 1930s and co-written by a Lenape elder who lived on a Six Nations reserve at that time, and who descended directly from the Ulster County area, actually. And so the dialect he spoke might be more reflective of the dialect spoken in Green and Ulster County. Mm-hmm. But I'd be happy to share that resource with people.
Yeah, and I would like to thank you for doing this work. I mean, not that I'm an Indigenous person thanking you, but I feel, especially lately, because I became an immigrant, basically, I left my homeland. I'm no longer in a place where, you know, my history belongs to. And what I had realized, even before moving out of the country, because the time changes and, you know, nothing remains the same. Mm. And so even as a Japanese person who was born in Japan, I felt more and more disconnected. I think a lot to do with the globalization of the whole world.
Yeah.
So that, you know, my mother knows a lot more about Japan, Japanese culture than I do. And even more so my grandparents' generation, they pretty much lived it. But like, I'm like very disconnected.
Right.
And so it's very hard, especially when you are not in that very land, because the connection with the land is what really keeps it alive, really. So it's like, but you don't want to just lose it.
No.
Like, you want to have the sense of, like, you're being on the very end of this long history. You don't just exist in vacuum. You belong to something bigger than you. And it's really historians and people who do research and archives and, you know, those information, you can say they're not lived thing. It's like, language being stored in dictionary is not the language people actually speak. And it's hard to say it's a living thing anymore at one point. Like some of the Japanese culture, it's hard for me to say it's a living thing. I don't wear kimono in everyday life. I grew up wearing this Western, you know, clothing. It's a sad thing to lose that connection with what is supposed to be part of who I am.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, I'm pretty much done.
No, I agree. I think that, you know, loss of cultural and linguistic diversity is as much a sign of, you know, so, you know, high loss of biodiversity is unhealthy for an ecosystem. And I think that's also true for humanity.
I totally agree.
Because the languages and cultures, they don't just appear, like you said, in a vacuum. That's knowledge that has been transmitted over time for more generations than we even realize, sometimes going back tens of thousands of years. And with that loss, you are losing part of what connects us to the local landscape. And that actually was difficult for me because my mom is from Italy, and my grandparents spoke a language that's dying. It's Lombard, and it's, you know, only the older generations, really very few people speak it who are under 70 years old today. And I grew up in the United States, but I worked hard to record folklore for my grandparents and to learn their language, which is, it's totally different than standard Italian. It is a separate language, although it is a Romance language. And I'm in this position where I have the opportunity to raise my own children to speak their dialect, even though I'm not totally fluent in it. But I've chosen not to, I raised them speaking Italian, but I've chosen not to with this local dialect because so much of it is tied to the landscape in that part of Italy. And where I'm raising my children here, we're, you know, in the homeland of Lenape people, we're surrounded by completely different plant and animal and, you know, bird species. So it makes it really hard for me to do that. And so I have to choose between raising them within the culture that I was barely raised in because of globalization, but that I really worked hard to preserve, at least in writing and audio recordings, or to raise them in between worlds, because we regularly work with Lenape people who are visiting, and they're, you know, they are, will be hanging out with their children. So yeah, that's a hard, was a hard decision to make. Yeah, it's sad that we're losing so much of this knowledge that took, you don't just gain that overnight. It takes so many generations, and it is a really, truly tragic loss.
Yeah.
So being able to dig through and recover some of what was lost and preserve what is still here, that's kind of why that's my life's goal.
Yeah, thank you for doing this.
Huge thanks to Justin Wexler of Wild Hudson Valley. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. And if you did, why not come out and visit us here at Wave Farm in Accra? Because today, this afternoon, Justin will be here leading a guided walk tour. He will delve into the history of local Lenape people, their relationship with the environment, and talk about their communities today. It's free, and it starts at 2 p.m. You can find more information at wavefarm.org. And Justin is giving some lectures and walks in November. There's one in Yonkers on November 8th. And then Star Lore Walk in New Paltz. This is on November 11th. And at the Ashokan Center on November 12th. And then in Albany on November 16th. Science Lecture Series, Place of Pitch Pines. The details available on the Wild Hudson Valley's website, which is at wildhudsonvalley.com. It's one word, wildhudsonvalley.com. There's an event calendar page where you can find all the information. We're going to close today's show with another track by Teyuna Mamos and Zaga of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. The track is called Ganulu, Great Black Messenger Bird. And again, this is released by Underwater Panther Coalition, a record label created to represent indigenous voices, run by WGXC programmer Matthew O'Neill, the host of Panther Mountain Sound. This program has been Bequency, and I have been Mayuko, and you are listening to Waveforms WGXC Radio. Coming up next is the Countdown, produced by Tom Rowe. New works from Matana Roberts, Matthew Ship, Black Duck. I don't think it's American Black Duck, but I believe it's some people from Chicago call themselves Black Duck. And others are featured, counting down 10 new sounds, stories, or songs, American Top 40 style. So don't go anywhere, or if you go somewhere, come to Waveform. Thank you for listening. I hope to see you next time. Thank you.
My